The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
17-year-old Carla Walker and the rest of her peers in tennis class presumably paid little attention as Fort Worth policeman James Johnson presented a film titled The Lone Woman on Thursday, February 14, 1974, Valentine's Day. After all, there was a dance to celebrate the Sweetheart's Day coming up on Saturday. It's easy to imagine that Carla's thoughts were elsewhere as Officer Johnson screened the cautionary film, which gave explicit instructions on what a girl or woman should do in the event of an attack against her. It was attending the dance with her boyfriend Rodney McCoy that was likely on Carla's mind. "Do not think this can't happen to you," the policeman strongly emphasized upon the film's completion. The evening of Western Hills High School's 1974 Valentine's Day dance, 18-year-old Rodney McCoy cleaned up after a day of service station work, hopped in his mom's 1969 Ford LTD, and headed to the Walker family home in Benbrook to pick up his date. Because he'd forgotten to bring the corsage that sat in the refrigerator and had to go back, he was a little late picking up Carla. When Rodney got there, he got the look, as he and others later called it. The icy stare was wiped away, though, as Rodney pinned the corsage on the Texas teenage Spitfire. The evening started out normal, just how anyone might expect. The lovebirds hit the floor, where Rodney flailed around in his attempts to dance, he'd later admit. A bunch of kids snuck in some booze, and Rodney and Carla continued their sweetheart's celebration with another couple, driving around, hitting all the cruising spots. After they dropped the other couple off, Rodney and Carla headed to the Ridgely Brunswick bowling alley to use the restrooms there. The day had turned to Sunday, February 17, 1974. They went in, did their business, and then went straight back out and returned to the 1969 LTD, parked in the dark back parking lot of the establishment. Not long after Carla and Rodney began making out, her head leaned against the passenger side door using her purse as a head cushion, the door was jerked open without warning. Both teenagers fell toward the abrupt opening, and immediately Rodney felt blows to his head. That and what follows here happened in a brief few moments. As Rodney was being bludgeoned, he lost his grip of Carla. "You're coming with me, sweetheart," a voice said as Rodney looked up to a pistol in his face. He froze. "I'm going to kill you," the voice now speaking at him. Click, click, click. The firearm's trigger was pulled, but no loud bangs accompanied it. Without missing a beat, the perpetrator pistol-whipped Rodney in the face and head. "Stop hitting him," Carla yelled. "I'll go with you." Rodney looked up at Carla and they locked eyes as she told him, "Go get Dad." The teenager lost consciousness, and when he came to an unknown period of time later, Carla and this man, this predator, were gone. For the following 3.5 days, multiple police jurisdictions, teenagers from area high schools, and adult volunteers combed the city for any signs of Carla Walker, until Fort Worth police officer Daryl Thompson discovered her body in a culvert off what was then called Holiday Park Drive, just west of Benbrook Lake. Carla, it was later determined at autopsy, had been beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled. Though the magazine for a specific model of .22 caliber Ruger pistol was found at the scene of the abduction, clues and leads in Carla's murder case were sparse. Or, more accurately, the technology needed to solve it was non-existent. It took 46 years for an arrest to finally come, though it was certainly not for the lack of thorough investigation. An incredible number of suspects were looked at, cleared, and even re-cleared after cold case detectives reopened the case in the early and late 2000s. Fort Worth homicide detectives George Hudson, Daryl Thompson, Leonard Schilling, and Sarah Waters all worked the case diligently over the years, as did major cases detective James Bennett and crime scene investigator Jack Bolton, among many others. Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator Jim Minter worked Carlos' case from day one and carried it with him after he stopped, through retirement from police work, until, in fact, just recently. One Fort Worth burglary detective, John Terrell, became emotionally invested and took Carlos' case to the point of obsession after he retired from the force. His suspect would ultimately prove to be innocent in Carlos' murder, though certainly not innocent in a series of other sexual assaults and one confessed attempted murder. But for years, retired Detective Terrell worked alongside Tarleton University police chief and acquaintance of Carla from high school, Jonathan Hudson, Carla's mother Charlene, brother Jim, sister Cindy, and the other victim in this depraved act, Rodney McCoy, keeping Carla's murder alive and in the spotlight. But it again faded from television news reports and newspaper headlines. In 2019, however, everything changed and a new chapter of Carla Walker's story, the final chapter, began unfolding. The following is the story of a loving and determined family, an affected community, persistent, methodical, and deeply caring Fort Worth homicide cold case detectives, brilliant and passionate forensic scientists, careful, compassionate, and thorough prosecutors, and the legacy of Carla Jan Walker. When we first came across Carla's story in 2016, we were terrified and disturbed by the brazen and confident way in which the crime was carried out. This was not the perpetrator's first offense, we thought, and probably not his last. As we researched, we discovered that Carla's case got some coverage in the papers and on television over the years, in random, short-lived bursts, usually near the anniversary of the heinous act. Most often, this coverage came as the result of the efforts of Carla's mother, Charlene, and retired Fort Worth burglary detective, John Terrell. But that attention seemed to have waned considerably by the mid-2010s. John Terrell died in 2010, and Charlene Walker in 2015, never having seen her daughter's killer brought to justice. At some point, Erica and I decided that, perhaps, a podcast would be the best way we could help to get folks talking about Carla's story again. We connected almost immediately with Carla's late brother Steve's best friend, Chris, and Kathy, who was a Western Hills High School student at the time of Carla's abduction and murder. Not long after that, Carla's sister Cindy and brother Jim placed their trust in us strangers. Something that likely was not easy. Something they certainly did not have to do. Rodney McCoy also placed his trust in us, and I have to point out that it was obvious to Erica and I pretty much immediately that he did not commit this crime. Even the publicly known facts and details of the case made it almost completely impossible for us to consider his involvement. Yet plenty of people ignored those facts and continued to publicly try and convict the man, this second victim. In July of 2017, we began releasing our episodes about Carla Walker. Folks definitely started talking, but unfortunately most of it wasn't the kind of talk we foresaw. There was a ton of finger-pointing, rumor, doxing, and the perpetuation of bad information. But to be fair, a lot of that had its origins in old newspaper reports. For instance, after interpreting the words of Tarrant County Medical Examiner Dr. Felix Quotes back in 1974, the press was responsible for a rumor that needlessly haunted the Walker family and Carla's friends. She'd been held and tortured for up to 3 days, the newspapers reported, but that doesn't appear to be true. On the lighter side of things, Carla was also reported as a cheerleader at some point, when actually she was a member of the school's pep squad. But anyway, decades-old misinformation was hardly the only unhelpful thing going around in 2017. Out of the woodwork came a so-called psychic who latched onto the Walker family, accused and doxed many friends and classmates of Carla, and whose visions provided nothing of substance or even relevance to the case. Perhaps their involvement even worked against the case, as did, likely, the tall tales of a Western Hills High alum whose stories evolved as they learned new details. This individual implicated many of his own high school enemies, and as his stories grew wildly out of control and self-contradicting, he'd managed to even cast a shadow of suspicion on himself. While Fort Worth cold case detectives were bombarded with all of this, in the end, after finding out that a complete stranger to Carla was responsible for the physical and sexual violence that led to her death, the bad information, tall tales, and wild accusations likely only proved to waste the cops' time. Erica and I always believed that one day the monster responsible for Carla's slaying would be found and brought to justice if he were still alive. Thanks to the thorough and diligent work of a couple serious Fort Worth police detectives, he was. In early 2019, Fort Worth homicide cold case detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett reopened the February 1974 murder case of Carla Walker. But we'll let the detectives themselves tell you how they became involved.
Jim called me, and at the time, you know, it had been, I believe, 45 years. And he was really frustrated, and he said, you know, he said, I just wish somebody could actually, you know, solve my sister's case so that we could know, you know, and he wanted to go to the Texas Rangers. And so after I listened to him vent for a little bit, I said, now, Mr. Walker, I said, let me ask you something. Are you looking for this case to be prosecuted, or are you looking to find out the truth? I said, if you had to choose, which would you prefer? He said, well, ideally both. He said, but if I had to pick one, I just want to know the truth. And I said, okay, I can work with that. I said, because what I can't promise you is that we'll be able to prosecute this case. I said, but if there's anything that we can do, then we will do what we can to move forward. And he goes, well, I just want a fresh pair of eyes. And I said, Jim, I am a fresh pair of eyes. And he said, huh, okay. And then at that point, you know, that kind of lightened the tone there. We started discussing it. And unfortunately, at the time, one of our detectives was ill. And so I left cold case and went back to active homicides for a while. And it was about another year. And then I came back. And then I was blessed with Jeff coming into my life at that point as my new partner. And so I said, Jeff, it's your first day, and I got something for you. And his eyes got real big, like, oh, crap. You know, he wasn't ready to be bombarded. And I showed him the two very large banker boxes full of Carla Walker stuff. And I said, I need your help. I've told this family that we're going to do everything that we can for them, and I need you to get started looking through this case file. And he was a champ. He picked up those boxes and said, I'll get right on it.
And that was middle of January of 2019. And she's not kidding when she said it was two very large boxes of information. If you can only imagine 46 years of information and prior detective notes, it was voluminous. And so just started going through and reading everything that was in both of those file boxes and trying to get a picture of what had happened first and foremost with the offense, and then how the detectives had looked at the case over the years. Then Lee and I had regular meetings and determining who we were going to interview and how we were going to move forward with the case. But I think it was really important to start from the very beginning instead of starting where detectives had left off with the case. And I think as, you know, Lee and I started going through all of the information, we started kind of getting a plan of attack and how we were going to approach the case. And ultimately, as we know today, it all worked out.
From the beginning, Detectives Wagner and Bennett knew that the many items of physical evidence associated with Carla's case had great potential for obtaining DNA evidence. But there was a problem. Funding for the testing of evidence in the homicide cold case unit was incredibly limited. Money goes fast, Wagner would later say at trial. There isn't much. Then, in late summer 2019, detectives got a call from NBC Universal, who were interested in producing Carla's story for their show on the Oxygen television network, The DNA of Murder with Paul Holes. Paul Holes, as I'm sure y'all know, helped identify the Golden State Killer, who was arrested in 2018 and subsequently took a plea deal instead of going to trial for his many crimes. Funding for the forensic testing of physical evidence in Carla's case was included in the deal between NBC Universal and the Fort Worth Police Department. That's when Mallory Pagankoff and Serological Research Institute in Richmond, California, or SERI, entered Carla's case. Mallory is a forensic serologist and DNA analyst.
As a forensic serologist, my job is to not find the killer or prove guilt or innocence. It's to examine the items and find the DNA evidence and then to go to court and explain that to people.
She's been with SERI for 3 years and before that worked for the U.S. military, where she worked to identify deceased service members. Mallory described for us the closely followed steps she takes when receiving physical evidence in a criminal investigation.
When they first come in, they get logged into our system, and so it gets assigned a case number, and each item gets assigned its own number. And then once that's all logged in, I examine it in the lab. I'll open up one item at a time. I'll take a look at it and do my tests.
SERI received many items of physical evidence associated with Carla Walker's case. 21 pieces in the first batch, in fact, on November 20th, 2019. There were several items in which stains were visible to the naked eye without the use of an alternative light source, including Carla's bra, but stains that would later prove to be the most damning evidence against the man who killed the 17-year-old Western Hills High School student weren't so easy to see.
So for the bra, when I took it out and looked at it, there were a few stains that I could see with my eyes. There was one reddish-brown stain, I think, on the left side that I could see, but there wasn't really any other visible staining other than that. So I used an ALS, which is an alternate light source, to examine the bra with. And when I did that, there were small areas on the bra that fluoresced, and those were the areas that I decided to sample from. Since certain body fluids will fluoresce, those were the areas that I was most interested in.
Mallory told us there are particular types of stains she's looking for when analyzing evidence.
So the main ones that fluoresce that I'm interested in are semen and saliva. Sweat and urine can also fluoresce, but not as brightly. Blood does not fluoresce, and touch DNA does not fluoresce.
One of the stains Mallory Pagankoff tested provided a single-source profile, meaning that only one individual's DNA was present. In this case, a man's DNA. She gave the profile the name Unknown Male 1. The second stain Mallory found using the alternative light source had multiple contributors, one of which, the strongest profile, matched the Unknown Male 1 from the first stain.
So the bra was cut in two. So the right half was 6-1 and the left half was 6-2. And then any sample that I took off of those items got labeled A, B, C, and down. So the first spot I sampled was the fluorescent stain that was on the inside right strap. It was the outside of the bra, but towards the inside, closest towards your chest. And that stain fluoresced, which is why I sampled it, and it was the single source profile. So the second stain that I took was just below that first stain. It fluoresced as well. It wasn't as strong as the first one, and it did show a little bit of a mixture, but it had a major profile in there, and the minor mixture wasn't strong enough to interpret.
The next order of business was to upload the profile into the FBI's Combined DNA Indexing System, or CODIS. Now, as Mallory explains, this isn't something that the Serological Research Institute does themselves.
So we, as a private lab, are not allowed to enter things into CODIS. We're not allowed to access it at all. So we have a partnership with a state lab who we have an agreement that we're going to process things in a certain way, the same way that they do. And so we will process the sample all the way through to typing and get our result. And then we will send all of our work over to them where they will review our work. And if they deem it eligible to be entered in for CODIS, they will then enter that profile in. After I send my work over to them, I'm kind of no longer involved in the process. If there's a hit, they will contact the agency directly. And so the only way I would ever find out if it got a hit or not would be if the detective told me or if they brought in a confirmation sample later on.
This same step, of course, was taken in Carla Walker's case. Unfortunately, uploading the Unknown Male 1 profile into CODIS produced no hits. Fort Worth homicide cold case detectives Wagner and Bennett weren't necessarily back to square one. They had a strong male profile to compare against their list of persons of interest, the list of individuals that included even those who'd been cleared in previous investigations. But visiting these folks and asking for voluntary DNA cheek swabs, which they did many times, was painstaking work, and it had the investigation moving much slower than the detectives cared for. They hit another roadblock shortly thereafter, when testing at another laboratory provided nothing. The detectives didn't know about Othram Incorporated yet. Here's Othram CEO David Middleman on the difference between what they do and the standard traditional STR DNA that's used for identifying matches in CODIS.
The way the CODIS system was started, and this was kind of started 30 years ago, popularized in the mid-90s, right? The idea was that if you know who someone is, right, someone's done something bad and you know who they are, they've been convicted of a crime, so you know who the person is, then what you can do is you can measure 20 markers. Well, it's 20 markers now. It used to be less markers. So you can measure these 20 markers, and you can put them into this system called CODIS. And then if they commit another crime, you can very quickly attribute them to that crime. So the point of CODIS from the beginning was to essentially confirm that someone was at a crime scene. And ideally, you know who the person is, so when they commit a crime scene, they can be put in there. The other thing is that when there's a new crime scene, you can pull markers from the crime scene, upload it, and see if someone that's already been known to commit crime was involved in that crime, right? So that's kind of how CODIS works. The way we do things is very different. You know, we're looking to find people that haven't been actually previously identified. And so people always talk about like this versus that, or which is better. As you saw in this trial, the tools work hand in hand together, because one tool is really good at finding people, and that's what Othram does. And one tool is really good at confirming that you found the person you think you found. And when you put the two together, you got really an unbeatable kind of line of evidence. So again, you use Othram to find people, and then you use the CODIS system, STR testing specifically, to confirm that you found the person you think you found. And it's not just using it to confirm it. It's confirming it using really well-vetted math that's been studied and tested in court for 30 years to say, look, the odds of this coming from someone else are just so tiny. So it's almost certainly this person that left the DNA at the crime scene.
David told us how Othram Incorporated became involved in Carla Walker's case after Paul Holes referred them to detectives, and how lab director John Fonden, or Trey as he is otherwise known, was able to get to work on the evidence right away.
Leah and Jeff came down here. They had just finished testing with other laboratory, and they had gone through that unsuccessful testing and had consumed that really good extract. It was consumed, which means, because when you test DNA, you destroy it forever, and it was destroyed. And I think they were not in the most trusting mood. But they were willing to come down to visit. They came in person. They drove down here in person. That's how important this case was to them. And they came down to visit because Paul had asked them to give it a shot and talk to me. And we walked them through the things that you already know about our lab, which is that we actually have a lab. We're the only ones to do this work in-house. And as such, we've actually fine-tuned our process. It's the only thing we do. We fine-tune our process to make it work really well for this one application of identifying folks from crime scenes. So spent a good number of hours walking them through it and They asked a lot of questions and made it very clear this is an important case. They had a little bit of, you know, a fractional amount of the original DNA that was left from this other extract, I guess from this other secondary stain. And they were willing to give it to us at the end of the discussion, but still very nervous. And so when it arrived, you know, I talked to Trey. I said, you know, look, let's see what we can do. I made no promises because, again, we have to do our QC and evaluation before we can know if things are going to work out okay. But almost from the beginning, it was just really good luck. I mean, we got the DNA just at the right time. You know, we planned kind of batches of processing, and it came right in time to just immediately get onto the machine. The QC revealed that the DNA was very, very fine. Definitely don't want to use the word clean, but, you know, again, by off-term standards, we were thrilled. It would be my dream to get a lot of cases like this that have DNA that is of decent quality and quantity and didn't have any overt issues that we thought would, you know, hang up the ability for us to analyze or produce a profile. So came in, looked really good. The timing was great, got onto the machine. And, you know, it was just good fortune that it did get onto the machine because it got processed a lot faster. We usually process in 12 weeks. This one was done in about, you know, 5 weeks. And when the data came off, you know, Trey went to look at it himself to see kind of what's there. And he saw these relationships and started working out the beginnings of the genealogy. And as he did that, he was able to narrow in on this family group. He let me know that. I was actually at the gym that Saturday morning just getting an early workout in. When I got the news, I just felt like he couldn't wait. So I called Jeff Bennett. This is the first time I was hearing in court that he was in bed, so now I feel bad. But I would have never known he was in bed, though, because I call him up, and he was, like, very alert, and he's, like, you know, ready to talk. And as I said, let me call in Trey. So I called in Trey, and we start talking to him about the results, and he immediately knew what we're talking about, and he's checking his notes. So I don't know. I guess he was in bed with his case file.
Here's Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett.
If we would have started where others had left off, Glenn would not have been on our list. So I think that obviously really benefited us at the end of the day. You know, because that takes me to July 4th and the phone call from David Middleman, 9 a.m. that morning. And when he told us that they had developed a last name and they told me McCurley, knew exactly what person he was referring to. And that was kind of an overwhelming moment because I knew at that point that we had identified the person everybody had been looking for 46 years. And then as soon as I got off the phone with David and Trey, I called Detective Wagner and we were both just elated. And when Othram called and I asked him, I said, would it be Glenn Samuel McCurley? They initially only had Glenn Samuel McCurley Sr. And they go, well, yeah, we got down to Glenn Samuel McCurley, but he died in 72 and your offense was in 74. So I asked him, I said, well, did they have a junior? Was there a son, Glenn Samuel McCurley Jr.? And they go, we don't know. We haven't gotten that far yet. So they called back about an hour later and said, yes, there is a Glenn Samuel McCurley Jr. He had two brothers, but Junior was the only one living in Fort Worth at the time. So that gave both Detective Wagner and myself a high level of confidence that he was our person. We just needed to start taking the steps to confirm that.
Kind of gives new meaning to 4th of July for us now, too.
Yes, it does. And we just knew we needed to put a plan on how we were going to move forward.
So we tried to figure out the best way to approach the situation, to identify the actual person without notifying the person that we were looking into them. We didn't want him to have any idea at that point that he was a suspect, because let's just say we found out that it was one of his brothers instead. You know, we wanted to fly under the radar as much as possible so that we didn't disturb anybody's life, you know, because nobody wants to be pointed at and said, you're a bad guy. And so that's why we went with the trash collection, because it was something that if we had obtained trash there and for whatever reason that DNA did not match our unknown male, we could have dropped it and moved on and then looked at his brothers. We don't take our job lightly. We want to make sure that if we are going to accuse somebody of murder, that that is our person. We want to take everything step by step to ensure that there was nothing forgotten, there were no holes, and that there was no way that it was anybody but that person.
This is what was in the reports from the initial investigation. On April 3, 1974, Fort Worth Police Department detectives Sinclair, Hudson, and Wood picked up 31-year-old Glenn Samuel McCurley at his place of employment and brought him to the station for an interview. The department had begun extensive efforts to account for all 22 Ruger pistols sold in the area, and McCurley's name was brought to these detectives' attention. They were also able to identify McCurley's name on a list of folks who had purchased magazines for that apparently very specific model of Ruger. But Glenn McCurley told them his pistol had been stolen prior to the offense while he was fishing a nearby river. Interestingly, it was reported in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram in 1974 that this search for 22 Rugers was performed, and out of hundreds of owners being checked, only one was unable to be accounted for because it had been stolen. Obviously, that owner was Glenn McCurley. The man lived around a mile from the site of Carla's abduction, was off work the night of and the day following, and his wife out of town the entire weekend. Though he'd been cleared in the initial investigation, Detectives Wagner and Bennett thought the chances were pretty good that they had their guy after they got the news from Othram. Swabs taken from the trash collected at the curb of the home of murder suspect Glenn Samuel McCurley, specifically discarded McDonald's straws, were sent to Serological Research Institute, or SERI, for the first confirmation. Here's David Middleman again of Othram Labs.
Next thing I know, they've done a trash run. Took a little time, but they do a trash run, and they sent the DNA from this trash run to SERI, as you know. For two reasons. First of all, we don't like to confirm things. It's always nicer when someone else confirms our work. And number two, SERI was the lab that did the original STR profile. So it kind of makes sense for them to do this confirmation because they can run the second profile and they've already got the results from the first one. They just kind of match it up. So they do it, and I'm sure you know it matches up. So then it's time for them to go to their house. He's a nice guy at the time and says, sure, you can have my DNA. And so then they take it willingly, thus demonstrating custody from his cheek.
On September 16th, 2020, Detectives Jeff Bennett and Leah Wagner were informed by SERI that the profile they had created from Carla's bra, known as Unknown Male 1, and the cheek swab voluntarily given to them by their suspect, Glenn Samuel McCurley, matched. But the word matched seems to under-exaggerate the science, the statistics, the level of certainty that these two profiles belonged to the same person. Here's Mallory Pagankopf from SERI.
So, because it was a single source profile and it was the same profile as Glenn McCurley, you can only provide a stat if there's somebody to compare it to and if they're included. And that's when we need to provide a numerical stat to show how inclusive they are. And so, for this stain, I was able to do a frequency statistic, which is called a random match probability, or an RMP. And that was the chance that a randomly selected unrelated individual would have the same profile is 1 in 48 octillion.
That's a 48 followed by 26 zeros. The population of this planet is just shy of 8 billion people, which is 8 followed by 9 zeros, if that helps with perspective.
The statistics that you heard Mallory discuss on the stand, right, the 1 in 48 octillion, these are statistics that have been developed. This is why CODA testing is so powerful, to basically compute probabilities that someone else that is, as he said, in the trial, not related to the person that you're testing, could have left those same markers. And these markers are chosen because the odds of these two people having the same markers is so low.
Justice for Carla Jan Walker, after 46 years, was finally on the horizon, and it came swiftly, especially considering the COVID-19 pandemic holding the world's normal day-to-day hostage. On September 21st, 2020, Glenn Samuel McCurley was taken into custody without incident and charged with capital murder for the 1974 slaying, 5 decades after the fact.
One of the most difficult parts of this case was knowing how this would affect McCurley's family.
Oh, absolutely.
So, like, when he was picked up on his arrest warrant, we made sure that the officers that went knew that his wife might have an adverse reaction to, you know, his arrest, to where she might need some sort of medical help or something. So they made sure that they had somebody close by that, you know, either had medical training or MedStar or somebody there, so that if, you know, she fainted or, you know, had some trouble, that there was somebody to take care of her as well. You know, we took those extra steps, you know, to try to soften the blow as much as possible.
He confessed in an interview at 2:15 p.m. that day, though he continued to lie about the details of what he'd done to Carla. But we'll get to that in the next episode or so. Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett officially announced the arrest the following day at a press conference. There, an emotional Jim Walker spoke of the 46 years he had been waiting for the arrest of his viciously assaulted and slain sister's killer. "Finally, finally," he said. After the arrest, McCurley had been booked into a Tarrant County jail, the Lon Evans Corrections Center, and a $100,000 bond was set. Just days later, on September 24, 2020, the case against McCurley for the capital murder of Carla Walker in 1974 was accepted into the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office. The following day, on September 25th, the DA filed a motion to have the accused's bond raised. It was successful. On November 11th, 2020, at 12:01 p.m., Glenn Samuel McCurley was officially indicted when indictment number 1657724 was filed with the Tarrant County District Clerk. The 2 counts of capital murder charges against him included the aggravated circumstances of kidnapping and sexual assault. 10 months later, the state of Texas began their trial to convict him. That's next time on Gone Cold. Carla Walker's murder is solved, but the city of Fort Worth still has nearly 1,000 cold cases dating back to 1959, the murders of Hattie and Vernon Stanley. If you have any information about any unsolved case in the city of Fort Worth, please contact the Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307, or you can email detectives at coldcase@fortworthpd.com. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of victims, to see people held accountable for crimes that consume, divide, and sometimes completely destroy lives, or help identify an unknown decedent, please visit DNASolves.com, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company, like Ancestry or 23andMe, for example, to their database. Your DNA profile will only be used for law enforcement investigations. If you have not tested with one of these consumer sources, but would like to help law enforcement identify violent criminals and Jane or John Doe's, you can go to connect.dnasolves.com to order a swab kit directly from them for only $15. At dnasolves.com too, you can see some of the other cases Othram has worked or is currently working on, and even be a part of solving a cold case by donating a little cash to one or maybe all of the law enforcement cases there that need help funding. What Othram does is changing the course of criminal investigations. As David Middleman puts it, the technology will soon be the rule, not the exception. Carla Walker's case is going to go down in history as an example for agencies across the country. Mark my words. We'll provide links to DNASolves.com and the Fort Worth Cold Case Unit in this episode's show notes. We'd like to thank Fort Worth Homicide Cold Case Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett, Mallory Pagenkopf of the Serological Research Institute, and David Middleman of Othram Incorporated for their contributions to this episode. Cindy and Jim, Rodney, and all Carla's friends and family. We love y'all and hope some peace has finally found you. Thanks to Kathy, Chris, Kim, Kathleen, Diane, Jonathan Hudson, Cindy VY, Kathy K, Renee, Buzz and Melinda, Cindy DC, Brenda W, Mary K, Rose M, Dee Underwood, and all the past investigators on her case, Carla's friends and classmates, and just anyone who has kept her memory alive and sought justice for her. Thanks, y'all. You're the best. Last but not least, thank you to all our listeners for helping keep Carla's case alive. As always, you can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and for just $2.50, you'll have access to episodes featuring stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, such as the Riverside Village Massacre and Fort Worth 1974, among others. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. We appreciate your support beyond words. Thanks for listening, y'all.